Over the last week, we've seen a lot of news coming out of the US and more recently out of Europe regarding their banking sector and the crisis that it seems to be in, how there are some banks that have collapsed, some that need help, some that have secured loans to prevent a future collapse. And so this is what we're going to discuss in this episode of Macro Sutra. How prepared is the Indian banking system to prevent a collapse like what happened with the Silicon Valley Bank in the US? I'm TCA Sharad Raghavan, Deputy Editor at The Print, and we have with us Radhika Pandey, a Senior Fellow at NIPFB. Thank you so much, Radhika.
Thank you, Sharad.
So now, Radhika, let's start again at the basic, which is what was the main issue with Silicon Valley Bank and, you know, like what were some of the mistakes that they made, as it were?
Right. So for this, let's understand what is the nature of Silicon Valley Bank. Right. It is a technology focused bank. Its depositor base is concentrated within the technology sector.
Yes.
So mostly the startups and the venture capital firms are the main clients of the Silicon Valley Bank. Now, recap the situation during the COVID period. During the COVID period, because of ultra low interest rates and flush of liquidity, these startups were able to raise a lot of finance at low rates of interest. And they deposited this money with the Silicon Valley Bank.
Right.
And therefore, we saw that since the COVID time till March 2022, there was more than twofold increase in the deposits of Silicon Valley Bank.
Right.
When the deposits rise, there are two options. One is that the bank lends. The other is the banks invests in government securities or other bonds. Now, during this period, we remember during COVID time, the demand was suppressed. So there was, the bank did not have enough demand for loans.
Right.
So therefore, most of the surge in deposits that was seen during this time was allocated in long-term government securities.
They invested it.
They invested, the deposits were invested in long-term US government securities,
right,
which are typically the most safest investment option. So there was no problem at that time. So they invested in government securities. Now, coming to the present time, coming to 2022, we saw that during this period, the Federal Reserve has increased the interest rates from zero to by another 450 basis points. So there has been a massive increase in interest rates. Now, what happens with an increase in interest rates? That the bonds that you are holding, their prices drop.
Yes.
Because we know that bonds offer fixed rate of interest. So at the time when the Silicon Valley Bank invested in those bonds, interest rate was low. Now, interest rate has risen. So the price of these bonds started to drop.
Right.
So there was this, you know, what is termed as unrealized losses on their investments.
Yeah.
Also, this is a time when the technology sector started to face a downturn. There was a funding crunch. So they started to tap into their deposits. They started withdrawing their deposits.
The so-called funding winter that has been happening.
Yes. So so there is a complete reversal of the period, what we saw during COVID and what we saw in 2022. In 2020, there was a flush of liquidity. There was low interest rate. Now we are seeing liquidity drying up and we are seeing interest rate tightening happening.
Right.
So the implication of this is that the bonds that the Silicon Valley Bank was holding, their market prices fell. So in other words, they were incurring what is termed as mark-to-market losses.
Right.
Now, because they wanted their funds, the clients of Silicon Valley Bank wanted their deposits back. They started to withdraw their deposits. For this, the bank had to liquidate, or in other words, sell their bond holdings to get cash and give to the startups, their depositors.
Right.
Now, when they started selling, they started incurring losses because the prices of these bonds fell because in the market the interest rate is higher.
So what you said, the unrealized losses
became realized losses. In a single day, they suffered a loss of $1.8 billion due to sale of bonds in a tightening interest rate environment.
This was last Wednesday.
Last Wednesday.
Right.
Then last Thursday, the chief, the executive officer, the CEO of Silicon Valley Bank issued a letter saying, and it is quite normal at this till this time that, you know, they have incurred losses. So they want to raise finance through the issue of share,
right,
which is quite normal. But this announcement triggered a kind of run on bank deposits.
A panic.
Because mostly the deposits were corporate deposits, their limit was much more than the insured deposits.
Which is $250,000.
$250,000 in the US. So because the value of deposits was much more than that, they thought there was this panic amongst the depositors that, you know, the bank is facing a liquidity crunch. So this is the opportune time to withdraw their deposits. So in one day, more than $40 billion worth of deposits were withdrawn on Thursday,
right,
just because of this announcement. And so much so that the bank was left with no cash at all. It turned insolvent. So that was the end of Silicon Valley Bank. And then the banking regulator of California took over.
Yeah.
And then it was handed over to their resolution corporation. Right. And the prompt regulatory intervention kicked in. So that's the track record of Silicon Valley.
And all of this happened less than a week. It started on Wednesday.
Yeah.
By Friday, the bank was shut down. And by Sunday, the regulators had made announcements that, you know, all the depositors are going to get all of their money back, not just the insured amount, but all of it. So just in a span of 5 days, all of this was sorted out.
Yes.
So now, the thing is that a lot of the basic elements of this story played out in India as well, where you had a low interest rate scenario.
Right.
And then after that, the central bank from May 2020, the RBI started raising interest rates.
Yes.
So what prevents something like this from happening in India?
We have also learned our lesson. And mm-hmm. What we saw is that in 2018, we do have some counter-cyclical tools, but the rules governing those counter-cyclical tools were refined in 2018.
Right.
So there's something called investment fluctuation reserve. That is what each bank is supposed to maintain, in which when the bank is earning profits from the sale of government bond, they have to transfer some part of their profits to this reserve.
Right.
So when will the banks earn profits? In a easing interest rate regime,
yeah,
when the interest rates are falling and their bonds are offering higher interest rates, so they will, if they sell these bonds, they will have a profit. To address this kind of a situation, this investment fluctuation reserve became very significant, where the profits from the sale of government bonds mm-hmm. during an easing of interest rate cycle was transferred to this reserve, and this was used at the time of the 2022.
Right.
So we have seen that, you know, it's not that Indian banks have not suffered. There are some estimates that around 15,000 crore losses were incurred by banking sector because of rise in interest rates,
right,
in the first quarter, that is April mm-hmm. to June of 2022. But because we had an investment fluctuation reserve where banks had transferred the profits, and there is a rule that they had to transfer profits equivalent to 2% of their bond portfolio,
right,
which is available for trading and sale. So let's understand, there are three kinds of bond holdings by commercial bank. One is that they hold to maturity.
All the way, yes.
Yes.
Till the full tenure of the bond.
Yeah. So basically, that is, if suppose it's a 20-year-old bond, they will hold for 20 years. They will not use it for sale or for trading. In that case, the problem of losses do not arise because
right.
they are holding till maturity. Hmm. Now, there are two other kinds of bond holdings. One is available for sale and the other is held for trading. Now, these are the two bond portfolios on which there is a possibility of incurring mark-to-market losses.
Or profits,
yeah.
Right.
So whatever valuation changes,
yeah,
this is the portfolio that will be subject to
price changes in the market.
Yes, price yeah. changes, interest rate risks
right.
Arising due to these abrupt changes. 2% of this portfolio had to be transferred in the investment fluctuation reserve. This was the rule that was announced by the RBI in 2018. So this came in very handy, and therefore it helped in preventing this kind of a widespread mark-to-market losses by the banking sector. So
right.
one of the key lessons is that one needs to have the these counter-cyclical tools to prevent, which serve as a buffer at a time when you have this possibility of losses. The second thing is that we need to have a more diversified depositor base. That was the problem with Silicon Valley Bank, because their depositor base is concentrated in just one class. That is not the problem with the, as of now, that's not the problem with the banking sector in India. And there was a stress test conducted by Jefferies where they have shown, it's kind of a stress test where they have shown that as of now, Indian banks are well positioned to avoid such a crisis, mainly because we have, our depositors are mostly the household. They are sticky depositors. There is a very minimal possibility of a bank run where they withdraw immediately and they put all their deposits in government bonds or any such thing. So that possibility does not arise. And coupled with the fact that we have an investment fluctuation reserve, it minimizes the possibility too. So to that extent, the problem is addressed.
Right. So there are two points here. One is that the RBI actually has put in place several prudential norms in our banking sector, which prevent these kind of crises from happening. Now, one of these was actually mentioned by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Shekhar Gupta, in Cut the Clutter, where he was talking about what was happening with Silicon Valley Bank. He mentioned, and this is absolutely true, which is that RBI has said that for all banks in India, we have to conform to the Basel III requirements, which are the global best practices norms that came up after the global financial crisis. RBI says that all banks in India have to do this. In the US, this is not the case. There was a big lobby that said that because these prudential norms are actually quite tough to conform to. So in the US, there was quite a big lobby that said smaller banks don't need to conform to the Basel III norms. And Silicon Valley Bank is one of those that actually didn't have to conform. And you saw what happened. So I feel that, the RBI has actually been very prudent in its regulatory norms. I mean, while we don't face any risk, even Jeffrey says that we won't face any risk from Silicon Valley Bank itself. But are there any lessons that we can learn from this? Like, are there any regulations we can additionally put in place?
Yes. So again, going back to the US episode, what they did, that there are these questions, like you rightly pointed out, on the regulatory front.
Right.
But the good point is that they swung into action very promptly.
Yes.
Within a matter of 2 days, we saw there was this very swift coordination between the Treasury Secretary, the banking regulator, and most importantly, their Resolution Corporation, which is the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation.
Right.
They swung into action, they closed the bank, and they ensured, because the most important thing is continuity of services for the depositors.
Right.
Anything, any crisis can survive if, depositors are secured. Firstly, the insured depositors, and then why not the uninsured depositors also.
Mm.
So that is what was the assurance given by these three set of regulators, that depositors' money will be protected. And most importantly, what they said was that this will be done without recourse to taxpayers' money.
Taxpayer money.
So
right.
These are the two important things that we can learn from the US episode, that while we do have adequate counter-cyclical tools put in place, which are also been put only after we suffered in 2018, we saw a series of crises in NBFCs. We have also seen a banking crisis like of the Yes Bank. So progressively, yes, our prudential norms have been made more strengthened. But despite the fact that we may have very strong prudential regulation, there is a possibility of bank failure happening.
Absolutely.
So when there is a possibility of bank failure happening, there needs to be an institutional framework to handle swiftly, very promptly, the failure to resolve a bank such that there is continuity of services for the depositors. So what happened in the US was that the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation has taken over this bank, Silicon Valley Bank, and they have set up something called a bridge bank.
Right, that holds on to the deposits.
Yes, so it's kind of an interim arrangement that they have set up till they find a buyer for Silicon Valley Bank. They have set up an interim arrangement called the National Bank of Santa Clara,
right,
where this is a bridge bank under the supervision of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and they will do all the banking business, the daily banking business that Silicon Valley Bank used to do. So in that sense, the panic is addressed, because at least the depositors have access to their money, because there is now a bank and it started functioning from Monday itself.
Right.
So two lessons. One is that it has to be very prompt. The regulatory response has to be very prompt. And secondly, there is a gap in our financial regulatory architecture in the form of a resolution corporation.
Right.
And perhaps the time is ripe to bring back that discussion on table and address concerns, because it's not that we have not thought about it.
Mm-hmm.
In 2017, the finance minister did introduce a bill on Financial Resolution and Deposit Insurance Corporation, the FRDI bill,
right,
but it was shelved because of certain concerns. Surely those concerns should be addressed, but at least the good point of that is that it will help in setting up a resolution corporation, which along with the banking regulator, which in our case is the Reserve Bank of India, will supervise, will monitor the financial firms, banks, and will look for early signs of trouble and take over the bank at a time when, you know, it's not, everything is not over. There are some,
right,
you know, initially when there are signs of potential losses, the resolution corporation can take over and, you know, adopt market-based resolution tools.
Yeah.
So that is these are the two lessons from the crisis, because what happened in case of Yes Bank, we have one standard recourse, which is that we merge it with another bank.
With a more successful, stronger bank,
which is in our case, the State Bank of India.
Right.
Now, arguably, it is taxpayer bailout, funded bailout, because it's a public sector bank, it's a sovereign guaranteed bank. So why not introduce measures, at least for smaller banks, to step in market-based resolution mechanisms.
Absolutely. And now the FRDI bill that Radhika was mentioning is actually one prime example of how one small element of the bill,
right,
can be blown out of proportion. So this, we're of course talking about this bail-in clause.
Yes.
That caused so much pushback that the entire bill got shelved.
Right.
And in the process, as Radhika explained, there were a lot of good measures that were not put in place. So it's perhaps time now to, you know, revisit those. I mean, the controversies can be addressed in any way that the government chooses.
Yeah.
But at least some of the good provisions can come in. You mentioned Yes Bank, and this is a question from our audience. They ask, we had seen a somewhat similar scenario for Yes Bank in 2020, which was handled pretty well by the government and RBI. Do you think it was because of stringent RBI regulations in terms of the cash reserve ratio and the statutory liquidity ratio, which allowed the central bank and the government to deal with such a situation in a better way?
So I think the main problem with Yes Bank was not related to CRR or SLR, the cash reserve ratio and statutory liquidity ratio. It was mostly due to lending, bad lending practices, concentration of lending in one sector that led to these problems, and the fact that their disclosures were not sound. So eventually in that process, the RBI has also strengthened the disclosure norms. So,
yeah,
you know, the disclosure norms, the regulatory norms have also been strengthened post the Yes Bank fiasco. So it is a combination, and the problem in Yes Bank was also brewing much before 2020. In 2018 also, there was a problem when they did not disclose it properly and they were asked to disclose properly. And even after that, there were problems 2019, 2020, there were problems primarily of hiding some part of their NPAs and not disclosing properly. So that was the main problem, and the way RBI handled, we've partly discussed that it was a collection of banks infused liquidity into,
right,
the Yes Bank, primarily the State Bank of India. So that is what we are discussing, that, you know, had there been a resolution corporation, maybe the regulatory response would have been different, and maybe the response would have been more quicker as compared to, you know, allowing things to deteriorate to such a situation.
And wouldn't have used taxpayer money.
Wouldn't have used taxpayer
yeah,
money.
Right.
So that is the thing, because, you know, there is a limit to which the the State Bank of India can keep absorbing losses, or an LIC can keep absorbing losses. So if we have a scenario where, you know, there is an established, and it's not just the US, we have these what is termed as effective attributes of resolution regime by the Bank of International Settlement, they explain that, you know, every economy should have a resolution regime.
Right.
In India also, we have a resolution regime for non-financial firms in the form of the IBC, the Insolvency and Bankruptcy Code. But we do not have a standalone resolution regime for financial firms. Though there are some provisions that have been inserted in IBC for NBFCs, the non-bank financial companies. But it is always better to have a standalone framework for financial firms, because their nature is different. They are accepting deposits. So they have this potential of systemic risk and, you know, the contagion risk, which may not arise in case of non-financial firms.
Right.
So there is a need to have, at least think about having a resolution corporation, and both the regulator and the resolution corporation should work in tandem to ensure that, you know, till the time they are able to address their problem, it is good. But at a time when they reach a situation when it's not possible, then it's better to promptly resolve the firm by various measures. So by setting up a bridge bank, or by finding a seller. And there are various measures that have been mentioned in the FRDI bill as well. So there is a standard toolkit of resolution tools which can be, you know, thought, discussed. The bail-in clause is controversial. Maybe we can drop it. Maybe we can introduce some riders. You know, when it can be introduced, it will not be used for public sector banks. So, you know, there could be many possibilities around discussing and introducing the FRDI bill.
Absolutely. And so now also, this actually raises a point. Broadly, there are two ways that a bank can fail. One, I mean, a bank is in business in two ways. One is it gives loans, and the other is it accepts deposits. And these are the two ways that it can fail as well. So either it gives a lot of bad loans and they become NPAs, and so then the bank is not getting paid back enough to give any more loans, or it has a run on it, like there's a bank run in which all of the depositors come and try to take all of their deposits out at the same time. So that's just some basic conceptual clarity I wanted to give. So now another question from the audience is, this is a broader conceptual question relating to the banking sector. What's the problem going to be with our banks? Will it be NPAs or lower credit offtake? Or will it be just this increase in interest rates?
So we are seeing a combination. So let's see what happened 3-4 months back. We are seeing, since then, we are seeing that our credit growth, the banking sector's credit growth, has been quite robust. But since December, January, there has been a slight moderation, which was expected given the rise in interest rates. So the interest rate rise that we have seen over the course of since May 2022, 250 basis points in case of India, it has started showing some impact on the credit growth.
Mm-hmm.
It's still in double digit, 15.5% according to the latest weekly statistical supplement. But yes, there are some initial signs of cooling off of credit growth by some industries. So basically, the slowdown is happening in large industries. But if you look at NPAs, I think the banking sector's position is quite good. We have seen a slide in NPAs over the last couple of quarters. Mm-hmm. The latest financial stability report tells us that the NPAs have dropped to 5% as of March 2022, and they're expected to fall further in March 2023. So NPAs is not a problem. Public sector banks are doing quite well. If we look at their balance sheet position, you know, the second quarter and the third quarter, we don't see that much of a problem. And the good thing is that for the last 2 years, the government has not recapitalized. You know, if we look at the budget item, the government has not been putting money into public sector banks. So this itself is an indication that banking health has improved.
Absolutely.
And banks are able to raise capital from the market. For example, we saw State Bank of India has raised capital from market through the issue of bond. So on the capital position front and on the NPAs front, there is, as of now, we don't see much of a problem. But yes, interest rate rise will have an impact. But at the same time, deposits will also rise. Going forward, what needs to be looked at is the net interest margin. margin, right? Which is the interest rate which they are getting on loans. The banks are getting on loans and the interest rate that they have to pay on deposits.
On deposits.
So there was a big gap between this, and that gap is gradually narrowing. At some point, depending on the interest rate cycle, it will stabilize. So that is one thing that needs to be seen. But overall, the banking sector's health in terms of the typical balance sheet indicators look quite sound.
Right. And now the final question from the audience, and this is kind of a little forward looking, which is that don't you think that all of this is a result of the aggressive interest rate hikes which the US Federal Reserve put in place? And now post this, can the US Fed afford to further increase interest rates, or will it do a pause? And now this is a very timely question, because as we speak, the European Central Bank is discussing whether to do an interest rate hike or not. They had earlier committed to saying that today they would increase interest rates by 50 basis points. But then after that, all of this banking, these crises happened, including what's happening with Credit Suisse. That's the million-dollar question, what central banks will do. So, yeah.
Yeah, so it is a tightrope walk between addressing financial stability concerns and addressing inflation concern. But I think looking, for example, particularly for the Federal Reserve, we saw just last week, Federal Reserve Governor Powell gave a testimony at the Senate and the Parliament, where he said that inflation is still a cause of concern, right, and he made it very clear that interest rates are going to stay higher for longer. So that was a very clear indication, and this was before the Silicon Valley Bank collapse. So if we leave that aside, in normal set of circumstances, Federal Reserve would have possibly gone in for a 50 basis points rate hike. Now markets are expecting a 25 basis rate hike, but the sensible thing would be to focus on their prime mandate, which is inflation,
right,
because to address the mark-to-market losses, there are other tools that should now be introduced in the banking regulation. So one is inflation targeting, one is banking regulation. One should not mix the two.
Right.
As a inflation targeting central bank, the Federal Reserve should go ahead and base its judgment on inflation trajectory rather than the Silicon Valley Bank collapse. And for addressing Silicon Valley Bank collapse, they should tighten their banking sector regulation.
Right.
That will help in addressing the mark-to-market losses. So I think that is the sensible way to go ahead, because if they do not, then it will be kind of an indication that yes, it was only because of their aggressive monetary policy tightening that things came to
that this problem happened.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So there you have it. Like, basically, the issue with Silicon Valley Bank is unlikely to be replicated in India for various structural and regulatory reasons. But that doesn't mean that there are no improvements that our banking sector can make. There are a few regulations we can put in place that will further strengthen our systems and prepare ourselves that in the event of a crisis like this, we can resolve it quickly, and we can resolve it in a way that the taxpayer doesn't have to pay for it. Looking ahead at what the other central banks are going to do regarding rate hikes, indications are that they're going to still hike rates, but by a smaller amount than they initially thought. That's all we have for you. Thank you so much for watching.